Right now, free speech is under heavy attack in New Zealand and overseas, with governments constantly devising new ways to enforce censorship. To make sure you never miss the critical news and breaking stories you rely on, join the RCR mailing list today. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.
Alwyn Paul is an educationalist, and his hot takes on what is going on in New Zealand education are pure gold. He's a perfect person to talk to in order to understand how the collapse of our education system has happened and what we can do to fix it. Let's talk with Alwyn now and find out his views on the latest revelations of the failure of our education system. Alwyn Paul, welcome back to The Crunch. Good to have you back.
Thank you, Cam. My pleasure.
You know, whenever there's things going on in education, the person I immediately think about talking to is Alwyn Paul. And you've got a bit of a track record in education. You've set up charter schools, operated charter schools, and you are a vocal person on the topic of education. So we've got a few issues in our system now, don't we?
Yeah, we do. It doesn't necessarily sit comfortable that I'm the charter school guy. I was interested. I met Andrew Little, and I'd never met him before, and I happened to bump into him, Russell, and I said hello, and I said, "Okay, my name's Alwyn." And he goes, "Oh, you're the education guy," and I went, "Huh, that's a little better than being the charter school guy." So, yeah. I mean, I did teach for 8 years in state schools. Did teach at St. Cuthbert's College. Established a private school. And was principal at the private school for 18 years and established a charter school. But I think it was Michael Laws who called me an education train spotter. and it has been really influential on my thinking in the last 5 or 6 years to dig deep into the data for New Zealand education, and particularly high school education. And not that I stopped doing it, but an initial dig into that probably sort of 20, 25 years ago, it led to three conclusions. One was that we were actually pretty good in terms of our year 1 to 6. You know, it wasn't too bad. That if you had a child get through to year 10 or the old form 4 in good shape, then they were probably going to do okay almost no matter what high school they went to. But that we really did lose the plot for our intermediate and first 2 years of high school, for which, of course, you know, there was no data, nothing you could do. But it has changed. And, you know, we've now got a huge disparity between the schools that are producing good results and those that are just producing appalling results. And I actually think it begins with parenting our 0 to 5s. That's a big deal. The government, I don't think, has a handle on that yet.
You talk about the data, and Christopher Luxon and Erica Stanford stood up at the National Party conference on the weekend that's just gone and talked about an abysmal record in mathematics at year 8. So that's just before you go to secondary school, right? Year 8. Yep. In old school terms, Form 1 and Form 2. Form 1 is Year 7, Year 8 is Form 2.
Correct.
And those numbers that they announced were appalling. Of course, Labor has argued against those numbers. Mm. They've got a better number, but it's only slightly better. But the end result is the majority of students in Year 8, and there's no other word for this, as I know it's a forbidden word, it's the F word. Failing. Only 22% of students at year 8 are at the expected standard for maths. Now, Labor says that, no, that's wrong, it's 42%, but either way, the majority of students aren't at the standard. In other words, they're failing. And 3 out of 5 of those students, or 60%, are more than a year behind. And it gets even worse if you're in the lowest decile schools. I know we're not allowed to talk about those anymore, because if you just remove the mention of the word decile, everybody's equal. But 8% of kids are at the curriculum level in year 8 in lowest decile schools, and nearly 80% a year behind in Maori are in a similar boat. What is that telling us about, like you were saying, you know, you looked over 6 years and it looked like we were pretty good up until we got to intermediate school and then the wheels fall off. Is this the wheels falling off or have they long gone and we've got a real disaster on our hands that could affect a generation of school children?
Well, Chris Hipkins came out. That's a forbidden term, isn't it? He didn't come out. Sorry, I mean, I'm not telling people anything unusual about Chris. But he said in the last couple of days, well, we can blame all this on national, and we can blame all this on national standards. Well, first of all, parents really liked national standards. They were by no means perfect. They had far too much pushed into them by the teacher unions to have what they called overall teacher judgment. And so you can have a kid, say, do a standardized test, not get a very good result, but a teacher thought they were trying hard, and so they would, you know, say that they were at standard. But this has very little to do with national standards. And one thing the national standards did show is that the longer kids were in our schools, the further behind standard they got. And there was a real drop-off at year 7 and 8. And, of course, we can't tell what happened in 9 and 10 because we didn't have anything. And we pretty much still don't have anything. So it could have been worse at year 9 and 10. We just don't know. And so we're kind of picking the end of year 8 as a little bit of a random number, whereas and we should have the continuity, which I think is one of the things that National is looking at with these standardized tests. But I think it's a bigger issue. And first of all, I've said it before on your show, I think we desperately need a non-ideological crown entity for parenting, particularly for during pregnancy, because we've got a really big problem with fetal alcohol syndrome and other things going wrong before birth that are highly preventable. Much easier to prevent them than to come up with solutions later in life. And for our 0 to 5s, because that's where so much of the brain is doing its learning development. It's a critical phase. People might say particularly between 0 and 3, but I think you can extend that, where all of the foundations for language, and math is a language, and the words in mathematics are as important as the symbols. All of those language and numeracy foundations are laid during that time period. And so you're getting, and you mentioned the lower decile, and that's statistically proven. Kids in poorer homes, by and large, hear thousands less words every day. And that's a big deal. So first of all, we have to deal with the 0 to 5s. And I guess governments often think, well, schools, we can do it, and, you know, we're more important than parents. They're not. Schools aren't more important than parenting. Schools are there to support parenting. But then, you get into our school system. One of the things that the teacher council has just said that is that new teachers or teachers entering the profession have to have level 2 mathematics. That's actually a really good start. I've only been saying that for about 6 years.
I'm astonished it's not the case now.
Well, it's not the case now. In fact, you have very little. And I think it was, well, one of the research people last year did something where it showed that so many, such a high proportion of our teachers feel inadequate in mathematics and in their ability to teach it. And so it's a one thing to say, oh, those coming into the profession, but there's going to be a huge lag there. So why not say to the people who are in the profession that over the next 3 years,
I'll get up to speed,
or support you to get a level 1 science, level 2 English if you haven't got it, and level 2 math. And that will make an incredible difference. New curriculum's nice if it's good. New methodologies can improve things, although often they freak people out and they put up barriers to applying them. But if you're standing in front of a class trying to teach them something that you don't know yourself, neither you nor the child's got a chance.
These numbers around mathematics, is this like the easiest thing to gauge? Because, you know, in maths, there's no in between. You're either right or you're wrong. There's no, you know, show us your work. You've turned quite well there, but you've missed the boat. But we're still going to give you a good mark because you tried. It kind of doesn't work like that in maths. Trying on an equation or whatever mathematical problem exists in trigonometry or geometry or anything else, it requires a right answer, and anything else other than the right answer is a wrong answer. So isn't it easier to assess where we're at with competency in maths? Because you either know it or you don't know it. And if you don't know it, well, that's simple. Whereas if it was history or maths, you've got history or English, home economics, you've got interpretations of what is right. You know, if you've got sound reasoning in a history essay, for example, you can still score good points because you've backed it up with some evidence and some things, and you're just looking at it slightly differently from somebody else. So it's more subjective. But maths is not subjective, is it? It's
And the higher you get, the less subjective it is. So my oldest did an engineering degree in the US. Well, his calculus exams and a lot of his other exams were, for instance, they might have three questions, and by three questions, they're not yes answers. They're an hour's worth of work. Yeah. And you got 33%, 67%, or 100%. And based on the answer that you got. Now, clearly, you have to be really good at the working. So there is a formative time when you can encourage kids to work through a problem, and they can see that they're almost there. So you're identifying where they make the mistakes. And so you can receive encouragement and some credit for that. But yes, ultimately, you want to get the correct number. So it is, in that sense, easier to measure. But there's huge method behind it. So, I mean, I've always taught kids that they ought to be getting 100% in any situation that they are doing math. Now, it might be early on, like when they're learning a new concept, that 100% might require a lot of help. So, you know, you go to your teacher, you work something out, you sit next to a neighbor who's doing it well, and you keep learning until you get it. But you don't give up. And I often talk to them about, look, math is like you're a mechanic and someone brings a Ferrari into the garage. You make sure that you do a great job. You get all of the help you need. You clean the car. It looks good, all that sort of stuff. And that's the approach that you need to bring. The second approach that you need to bring to math is I just have four or five saying with kids that I would repeat ad nauseum. And first of all, math is doable. A lot of adults have got this huge barrier to math, and you've got those great sayings like, oh, it's different than when I did it, or when are you going to use that in the real world, and all of this sort of stuff, which it's the last thing that kids want to hear. Or he doesn't have a math brain, or she doesn't have a math brain. And there's no such thing as a math brain. So I'd say to kids, you know, first of all, math is doable. Second thing, there are only four operations that you need to worry about. So math is like playing tennis. Tennis, you've got forehand, backhand, volley, smash and serve. That's it. And you've got some variations on that, and you have to be pretty darn good at it. But you've only got addition, subtraction, multiplication, division. Just about everything else is a variation on that. And you can break that actually down to two. Inverse is math and, multiplication, division are inverse. Addition and subtraction are inverse. So if you perfect that, it's a good start. Then there are rules, you know, just like in tennis. You've got to keep the ball in the court and things like that. There are rules that you need to follow in math. And the key one is the order that you do things in. And then there is language. And the further you go up, there are more words or more phrases that can freak you out when you first hear them. So you always say to kids, attack the language. Find out what the word means, because they're not using the word to confuse you. They're using the word to stop you using a sentence to describe something. So it's specific. It's a language. And then the other thing, and I think it's a thing that we struggle with in life now, and that is you need to do a crap load of work to become good at maths. You don't walk into a class and absorb it because the teacher tells you one thing. You need to repeat stuff. You need to ask questions. You need to engage in it. So from all of those perspectives, it's not just that a lot of our kids aren't very good at math. It means that they're not very good at learning. They aren't being taught how to go about things to become good.
Well, that's where I was going to get to, because my experience of maths at school was decidedly average.
Mm-hmm.
I think I only passed about three or four exams in maths, and from the fifth form onwards, it was a downward slide.
Yeah.
Yet I was scoring, 90 in the 90s in English and history and, other subjects like that. And I actually put it down to the teachers that I had at the time. Mm-hmm. I had English teachers that excited me about English. I had history teachers that excited me about history, so much so that, everything I do, I always look at a historical or historiosity to look at politics or religion or anything like that. It gives you a good basis. But I had nobody who excited me about maths. In fact, I had the exact opposite of that. I had a world-renowned maths teacher, a very famous name, and if I asked you, as an educationalist, who the top maths teacher is in New Zealand, you'd probably say his name.
Well, maybe not.
Yeah, maybe not. He was a sports person, a famous sports person in weightlifting, and then went on to be a teacher in mathematics. Uh-huh. Quite well known. Ended up at Maclean's College. But before that, he was at my school when I was a kid. And he was hardly ever in the class.
Right.
And when he was in the class, he sat up the front and told us which pages of the textbook we were to work through and which page of the quiz at the end of the chapter we had to do for homework.
Mm-hmm.
And that was this world-class teacher teaching maths at one of the top schools in New Zealand.
Yeah, I mean, my experience with math at school was similar. But So I'd actually dropped it by year 13, by the seventh form. And in my ignorance, and I'm thankful for that ignorance now, there were two reasons why I chose to do an economics degree, an economics major. One was I thought it would be descriptive and there wouldn't be much math in it. And the second one was I was terrified of public speaking. So anything that didn't have a seminar was a big plus in my book as I went through the university calendars. So I kind of flew through the first year of a business degree and opened my textbooks for my major, and it was all differential calculus. Mm. I was terrified, and I thought, okay, well, what are you going to do? And it was Massey, actually, Palmerston North, when it was in pretty good shape. And so I did a course called Methods of Mathematics, and I went right back to the beginning. And it was probably the best academic thing that happened to me, because I had to go back to absolute first principles in math and also learn how to learn it.
Mm.
And it took a heck of a lot of effort, but ultimately my economic statistics paper, I think I was the only A+ in the course. My advanced economic theory was a pretty solid A, and things like that. So it wasn't ability. Again, it was. I think the way I'd been taught, and sometimes when we're at school as a young person, we're not the best students in the world, and we don't take it upon ourselves to learn. But that's what being a young person is. You need someone to lead you into that situation. And I love teaching kids math. I love teaching them the basics of science. I actually quite enjoy teaching them economics, but with math, you've got that background to it that when they start to succeed, they are delighted because they're doing something well that they've probably heard so many times they won't be able to do. And they can fly into it. And we have problems right through the levels. One of the issues with the NCEA is that you break the course into achievement standards, and a kid goes, well, I don't like statistics, so I can still get through, I can still get my sort of 12 to 14, 15, 16 credits by ignoring statistics and doing the other ones. Mm. Well, you know, you're starting to shrink down the size of the course that they're actually being exposed to, because if they know they're not going to do it. Plus, when you get to universities, a lot of exam sitting, and a truckload of our kids are leaving school without really having sat an external exam. Because they don't need to, they've already got the credits. So as I say, this is not a year 7 and 8 issue. This is a parenting issue. It's a foundational issue in our schools, partially because a lot of our teachers, by their own admission, you know, I'm not picking on them, by their own admission, are not good at the subject, afraid to teach it. Plus, we don't really measure until it's too late. And then we've got these other issues further up. It's a great subject as well. I mean, you know, you school kids up for a lot of things in life if ultimately they can do reasonably well at the subject.
See, the thing is, my recollection of schooling is all of bad teachers and the very good teachers. I really could count on the fingers of one finger. But I'm looking at these results and I'm sitting here thinking, this is pretty bad.
Mm-hmm.
Now, putting aside the parenting issue, because that's a whole nother order of magnitude of difficulty to solve. So
it has to be solved.
It has to be solved, right? Yeah. But in terms of putting a finger on something to address this, parenting has a role, absolutely, mm-hmm. right? Yep. And we have a societal deficit when it comes to parenting.
Yep.
Let's put that aside and let's talk about the education system. We always have been told, you know, by various different people that we have a world-class education system, that we are better than everybody else, that we have better ways of doing things.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a piece of empirical evidence that suggests that that's not the case. And if that's true, and let's accept that it is true, And we can argue about the number, whether it's 22% or 42% or somewhere in between, mm-hmm. right? That's an indictment on the system and those who are in the system that this didn't happen overnight.
No.
So the very people who have been gaslighting us about whether we've got a world-class system are the ones that are in that system, and you actually have to hold – it's maths, right? It's right or wrong. We've got 22% or 42% passing. Everybody else is failing. Occam's razor says the system's the problem and the people in the system.
Yep.
And then when you start picking into that, you've got a highly unionized workforce.
Mm-hmm.
You've got about essentially three teacher unions for senior teachers, in secondary school teachers and obviously the junior school and early education teachers, there's three different unions. And no one's prepared to say, you know what, guys, see that number, that 22%? That shows that you're failing, that your systems are failing. And when you fail, you don't just get an F, right? And there has to be consequences for that.
Yeah.
And part of that consequences should be, we're not going to listen to you anymore, because we've listened to you for the last 30 years since Tomorrow's Schools came in, you know, under David Longy, and that was going to solve everything. And here we are 30 years later with worse statistics than when they started. Something's wrong. And you're the only common denominator. And we're going to talk maths again. You're the common denominator in all of this.
Yeah.
And if somebody does that, the parents of this country are going to go, hallelujah.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure that Erica Stanford or Chris Luxon have got the stones or the courage to confront the teachers' union about what is obviously a failure.
Well, they have made a start. And I think the other day is the first time that Erica Stanford, brought the union failure into the discussion. And I mean, there are big issues with the teacher unions, and I think they need to solve them. I mean, they are going to have a part in the New Zealand education system moving forward. And therefore, they need to ask themselves a question. Are they going to have a positive part in improving our system? Or, for example, are they over the next 6 years just going to bang on about charter schools? And one of the big
answer right now.
Well, I think I know the answer too.
They
but
I bang on about charter schools, and that raises a really good point now in the whole discussion.
Yeah.
The last time we had charter schools, the unions vociferously opposed it. The Labor Party backed them up, and as soon as the government changed and Labor was in charge, that was the end of them. How are we going to ensure that? I've been looking at some of the submissions on the new charter schools legislation, and you've got rote answers. It's ironic, really, isn't it? Teachers that abhor rote learning are teaching their union members to write rote replies to submissions that all say there's no evidence that charter schools work. But it doesn't take very much effort to find evidence, such as, you know, the 2023 National Charter School Study, version 3 from Credo, which gives you ample evidence that charter schools actually work.
Yeah, if you go back to the union thing, I mean, from my experience, I think I lasted as a new teacher at Tauranga Boys 3 weeks in the union before, you know, I realised that they were basically just a bullying organisation. I got a note from someone in Christchurch the other day who had gone to one of the most recent meetings. He said anyone who spoke from the floor about some of the positive possibilities of charter schools were shouted down. So, you know, is that the behaviour you want in a classroom, for instance? So they don't model behaviour very well. It then didn't take long to work out that in most schools, the person who is the union rep is the person who's going to be most likely to be in need of the union because they're often the most appalling of teachers. And so, you know, you get, I'm going to say, the rabble rising to the top, and a massive amount of teachers belong to unions just because of the pay negotiations. They don't want all this other nonsense going on. They'd much rather have a professional association that represented them properly, not the situation that we've currently got. And you're right. I mean, their submissions were just appalling. You know, no evidence. Well, I can give them evidence of schools that I started, schools that Nick Hyde started, schools that Raymond Tipene started that succeeded within New Zealand. I can give them evidence of schools in New Zealand that are designated character, like St. Joseph Māori Girls in Napier, which is in the top 20 schools in New Zealand, despite being a low decile school. Manukura Palmerston North, also in the top 20 in New Zealand, despite being a low decile school. So these are schools with variation in them, which are also, you know, pretty much ignored by the unions. You know, plus they'd say just the usual nonsense. You know, we don't want a system where people can make profit. I think anyone who can make profit out of the charter school budgets really should be the new Minister of Finance, because the way it's budgeted for through government, it's just not possible to make anything substantial. And most, if not all, will set up as charitable trusts or charitable companies like I have. You know, that we're allowed to, charter schools are allowed to employ non-qualified teachers. Well, there's 2,000 teachers in the state system on limited authorities to teach. That is unqualified teachers teaching in the state system. And so I don't know how they sit there and spout this stuff and then go back to teach a classroom and ask the kids for integrity.
It's almost like, you know, these are what we need to oppose this no matter what. There's no, it's not an educational answer. It's an ideological answer.
That's right.
Now, in the United States, the charter school movement has been exceptionally good at selling charter schools to the public and beating the teacher union.
Yeah.
The way they do it is different, right? They start by having the right people doing the selling. Mm-hmm. Parents and the kids who would be at failing public schools without a charter, right? Yeah. Then that means that they also get, you know, people of colour talking about how the public schools don't serve the community well, rather than some of the white funders of the charter movement, right? So you're getting parents who have got kids who are affected by the public schools doing a poor job saying this is what we want. And then they make the discussion about education a discussion about civil rights rather than an industrial relations issue.
Mm-hmm.
And then people start to realise that charter schools can be part of the community.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a hugely different, even media tone this time, which is good because people know that we need this. I mean, the unions, one of the other things they kept saying the other day is that we already have choice in the New Zealand system. Well, they are putting themselves in the place of defending the choice that only the wealthy or the Catholics have. And so we have in New Zealand, we have got 2,112 state schools. We have 91 private schools. We have 335 integrated schools, 226 of which are Catholic. Now, to go to a Catholic school, there's a significant barrier. To go to a private school, there's a significant financial barrier. And so where's the choice? And where especially is the choice for the kids who don't have any money, who can't shift into the grammar zone, who live in a small provincial town and their parents aren't wealthy enough to put them in a boarding school?
Or Catholic or Anglican or Presbyterian.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah. So I think charter schools were hamstrung last time. And that may be an erroneous view, but I felt that the National-led government wasn't that keen on them, and so they just let it, you know, just sort of gave it lip service, and then consequently it was easier for it to be overturned. But everybody, almost, it seems to me that the American way of getting parents who have suffered at public schools to front this is the way to go. I mean, mm-hmm. almost all of us have experience of going to school where there were good teachers, very few of them, and bad teachers, a lot of them. But they're all paid the same.
Yep.
So there needs to be a case made that the real world means reward for merit and achievement, not for turning up. And if we can do that, that will help us pay better teachers more than the dud teachers.
Well, one of the union people who was submitting actually had to submit after me the other day. And I said, you know, that we paid our teachers more than state. He was blown away. He had no idea. I mean, he sort of looked at the people in the select committee and said, well, why doesn't everyone know that? And of course, and I mean, if I'm employing a first-year teacher and he or she's doing the job of someone who's working at top of the scale, I'm going to work very hard to have their income equal. You know, you're not going to pull down the other person unless they're doing an appalling job. But if they're doing an appalling job, I wouldn't employ them anyway. And yeah, it's a big deal. You were right. You're right. I think National, the blowback on charter schools, the orchestrated blowback on charter schools, bothered them because, you know, they were really conservative in their approach to lots of things, and their main aim was being perpetually in government, not improving the country. I think that's different this time, or I hope it's different, and. I'm well aware of a significant amount of the people who are applying to become charter schools. There are some really good applications going in from some strong organisations, and so it's going to be harder, much harder, for Labor, you know, when they get back in 30, 40 years' time, to sort of crap all over them again.
See, I look back in history again, you know, I said that earlier, history gives us some good lessons.
Yeah.
Look back at Obama in 2010,
mm-hmm.
he was president, and he went to war with the teacher unions.
Yep.
He came out with a policy which he called race to the top reforms. Yep. And he was accused of by the teacher unions of scapegoating teachers when the problems were more systemic. But he identified it quite squarely. He actually said, no, actually, teachers are to blame here and bad teachers should be fired and if they can't train kids to succeed. Listen to these words. This is from a Democrat, right? Imagine if we could have these words come out of a Labor Party leader or even Mr. Luxon. He said, you've got to have radical change. And radical change is something that's in the interest of students.
Right.
We've got to be able to identify teachers who are doing well. And ultimately, if some teachers aren't doing a good job, they've got to go.
Yep.
Do you agree with Obama on that?
Yeah, I do. And again, it starts at the top. I mean, a lot of schools, teachers will say that they're stressed by the amount of busy work that they have to do. A lot of that happens because you've got middle managers or senior managers in schools who are pushing the busy work onto them because they're kind of justifying a role when they're sitting in an office for 9 or 10 hours a day, and they've got to think of something to do. So the first thing they think to do is get someone else to do something. So at least they've, you know, got some research going on that they can then respond to later. Rather than going around the school and dropping into classes and doing some work with the kids themselves and all that sort of thing. I don't think Hipkins or Tonetti really did anything of worth as ministers of education.
They protected the hegemony of the teacher unions is what they did.
Oh, very much so. And I still remain astounded that Ardern stood up when they had passed the law to close down the charter school model, and she said, as we promised to the teacher unions.
Mm-hmm.
The families, the kids, all of those sorts of things aren't their first priority. Do you need good teachers in your system? Absolutely. And if a teacher is there just collecting their paycheck, you know, go and get another job, go and pick fruit. It needs to be your passion, and because the children depend, not entirely, but they depend on you for an aspect of their future that you're supposed to be helping them with. And if you're not, go away.
What would happen if the Ministry of Education closed its Wellington office, sacked all its bureaucrats? Do you think the students or the parents would notice?
I think the ministry should have a really important role. And not that I necessarily think I'd ever lead it, but I think the first thing the new person coming in when Iona Halstead leaves to do is to send a survey to every principal in the country and say, what do you need from us? How can we help you and your school do a better job? What problems do we create in our current mode? And those sort of things, because their job is to serve the schools so the schools can serve the children.
Mm.
And anything that they're not doing in that realm, they shouldn't be doing at all. And same in a school. If there's anything you're doing that's not actually for the benefit of the kids, don't do it, because you exist for the children. That's what a school is. And that's not to say you don't have staff socials, you don't, reward all of that stuff is about building that sense of purpose and reward for people who are doing things well. But the ultimate aim of that is to improve what they do for children.
Mm.
You've got to be really singularly focused. It's a big deal.
Well, you know, hopefully the government is grasping the nettle, to coin a phrase that's often overused. Most people actually have never grasped a nettle, so they don't know what that feels like.
Yeah.
Being a hunter, I have, and it's not pleasant. But it looks like they're prepared to beard the teacher unions and say, well, here's the numbers. This is the proof. Show me why this is wrong.
Yeah.
And until you can convince me that I've misread these numbers somehow, we're not listening to you.
Yeah. Well, you've also got to take into account. So it's difficult. Their aim is by, I think, 2030 to have 80% of kids at standard. Now, that does raise some questions for me, because we all know who the other 20 are. And so, look, they're probably the ones that even Obama would say, these are the ones that we need to lift. So I think we need to be a bit more ambitious than that. We're also in that situation where we talk about being at standard. There has to be some incentives there for kids to excel as well. So I know it's a soundbite, but there has to be a little bit more detail behind that to say exactly how we get there and what that means and how many kids have we actually got absolutely flying on.
If we get to a point where the standard has 95% of people meeting that standard, isn't it to raise that standard?
Obviously you want to keep improving. And our foundational teaching is so important in so many areas. Your scientists to be taught really thoroughly, you know, how to use the periodic table. And as you would say, the history of it, how amazing these discoveries have been, but also true science that we still don't know everything about it by any stretch of the imagination.
They change when we learn something more.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And that's exciting. I mean, I say to any family, you know, one of the most important books you can have in your house is Bill Bryson's Short History of Nearly Everything. Now, it's a great read. He inspires you to look into science. But even that, I think it's probably about 10 to 15 years since its release.
Yeah.
There's been several updates, you know, because the stuff that was known 10 or 15 years ago is significantly different in many areas. And so, you know, that's why the stupidity of that saying the science is settled. The science is not settled on anything.
Just about to raise that, because when they, and I was going to say that's part of the systemic problem there is in teaching, right?
Yes.
There would be probably 95% of teachers agree with that the science is settled on climate change.
Yeah, or on anything.
So what they teach at their school is not actually science. What they're teaching now is that this is accepted.
Yeah.
And you, therefore, anything that you have to say against this is spurious. I mean, I had a problem with that with my daughter. You know, she was asked to write a paragraph, I think, in year two or something on climate change. And being my daughter, she wrote climate change is a fraud and a few other things. And I got called up by the teacher to discuss the issue, the problem of my child.
Right.
And I said, well, what's the problem? Well, she's wrong. I said, but is she? Do you know that? Did it write a paragraph? Did it have an opening sentence? Did it have a closing sentence? Did it have some stuff in the middle that supported the beginning and the end?
Yeah.
Yes. Well, did she write a paragraph? Yes. Well, why haven't you given her 100%? Because she's wrong. No, you asked to write a paragraph about a topic. It doesn't matter whether she was right or wrong about that topic. It wasn't a topic. It was about teaching them to write paragraphs.
Yeah. I love working with kids who you know, we're supposed to be doubters, skeptics. In life, we're supposed to challenge everything. And you know, most movies are about that, aren't they? They're about that person who flipping challenges everything, but we hate it in the real world. I was teaching a class once and really cool year seven kids. And if I'm doing the basics of science, I try and teach it as thoroughly as I can so it doesn't have to be untaught later. So, you know, I taught them that the boiling point of water is 100 degrees Celsius at one atmosphere. Mm. And then we talked about the variation. So when you go to Rotorua, they tell you that some of the water is 200 degrees Celsius a bit down. And, you know, the kids go, well, how the heck is that possible?
It's still a liquid.
Yeah, because it's deep down, you know. And a poor teacher's college student came in and said, well, we all know that, you know, water boils at 100 degrees. And you had 12 hands go up in there with such rapidity that the arms nearly came out of their sockets. And the poor guy, he didn't know, you know, that it was that one atmosphere and all of these variations. And, you know, to me that was a little sad because he'd got through, I think, NCA science without knowing a foundational truth that's incredibly important. And I mean, back to these submissions. So that's where I think the unions have really lacked integrity because, you know, they say, well, this $153 million that's going to charter schools, if that was spent in the state system, and you're like, hang on a sec, it's 0.07 of 1% of vote education. Mm. It is comparatively a tiny amount. And they keep saying, but we could get 700 teacher aides funded through this. Yes, that's 0.03 of a teacher aide per school in New Zealand. If it's solving a problem, find your $153 million somewhere else. If that's, you know, if that's the fix. And I just think lack of integrity from these people who would like to be known as professionals is a really big deal for our community, let alone striking, teacher-only days, all of these things that impact on kids that they just don't care about.
Political activism, you know, where they get all the kids to make signs and march down the streets for whatever cause the teachers are into.
Yes.
But we could talk for hours about this, Alwyn. Yep. But I just wanted to give listeners an idea about, we have a problem in our education system.
We do.
The problem rests as much with parents as it does with those who are in the education system. Mm-hmm. Parenting's a big problem.
Yep.
But the education system has got a systemic problem there, and we actually need to look at addressing that. And when you nut it down to it, it ain't the kids' fault.
I think that's a really, really big deal. You slowly build children into taking responsibility. And if they don't, then obviously there's a fault that lies there. I mean, I often talk about school should be a 300% model. You know, you need to convince parents that their child's education 100% depends on them. Have you got them organized? Are you interested? Are you engaged with the school? Because all of those things we know make a big difference.
Yeah.
You've got to convince your teachers that it depends 100% on them. Yep. They have to be good. They have to know their subject. They have to be very caring, which matters to kids. Yep. And 100% depends on you. And then over time, the kids have got to come up. But when you've got a 5 or 6 or 7 year old, you know, probably a 13 or 14 year old, the child isn't going to bring 100% every day. The adults in their lives have to do that. And, you know, it's so important. It's so foundational to our society. And if people want to look at it from a financial perspective, as, you know, Cameron Bagri often says, our productivity depends on a good education system. Every kid that fails, again, if you want to look at it this way, costs our country hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Oh, millions.
In a range of ways, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, that seems a very good note to finish this interview up on, that striving for excellence is probably the way out of this, if only we could get everybody to agree that winning's a good proposition.
Well, I just think if you want a winning situation, I think Christopher Luxon and Erica Stanford have made a start. You know, they stood up. There was a political aspect to it, but ultimately they were saying something that's really important.
Yeah.
And now they've got to push on with it. But I think you're right too. I mean, it would be a stunning, but the teacher union should stand up and say, look, there's a big heap of truth in this, and we are going to spend the next 3, 5, 6 years improving that teacher profession and have this kind of driven.
You know, you touched on it, and I kind of have as well, but I mean, explicitly, if you teach a kid to win, mm-hmm. right, it doesn't matter whether it's sport or a chosen subject,
yeah.
if they're used to winning, they want more winning.
Well, the neat thing about academics too is, you know, clearly the Olympics are on as we talk. And it's a 1 or 3 winner, depending how you look at it, contest.
Yeah.
Well, academics isn't like that. Every kid in your class
can be a winner.
Can go on to achieve something remarkable that maybe you haven't thought of, their parents haven't thought of, But you can elevate them into a situation where they think of it and they get stuck in. And that's what is rewarding about being a teacher. I've never worked a day in my life because it's just the most amazing industry, I suppose. What do you call it? Sector to be involved in.
Yeah, and if we teach kids to seek success and enjoy success, you look at sales reps, you know, commission-only sales reps, they get their enjoyment from winning, from getting that sale, from getting that commission.
Yep.
Week in, week out. If they're not getting commission, they start getting grumpy. If they're not getting the sales, they start getting grumpy. But who's responsible? That's for it's the individual.
Yeah.
But you can be trained into doing certain things that will ensure that you are a winner in your chosen field, whether that's academic or sports or anything else. That people who rise to the top are the ones who are prepared to build that habit of winning.
Yeah.
And that's how they do it. But everybody can win at their own level. But
correct.
But not being able to do maths in year eight, that's not a winning recipe for.
No, and if you don't, if there's no change brought to that situation for that child, a large part of their options are shut down, and that's the human tragedy with it, and it is a big deal. And I'm glad we've made a start.
Well, and we've got to have these discussions as well so that everybody can actually speak up and say, no, we want to develop this attitude within our schools and have agency, at least have agency on behalf of your own children.
A lot of these organisations get to sit around a table in Wellington. They call themselves the peak bodies in education. There has to be a parents group built into that now. I think that is absolutely crucial. Someone who can sit at the table, because School Trustees Association don't do it, someone who can sit at the table and say, from a parent's perspective, this is what we're seeing. And I think that's crucial.
And on that note, Alan Paul, thank you for coming on The Crunch and talking education with us.
My pleasure.
Alan is so calm and patient, and it shows you the kind of teacher and educator he is. Such wise words on what the issues are and how to fix them. Clearly, we need to do something, because what we have been doing in education hasn't worked and has actually made things worse. Tell me what you think. Email inbox@realitycheck.radio or text to 2057.
Thank you for tuning in to RCR Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to, dislike what you're listening to, either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. Or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you, so connect with us today.